Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, immerse yourself in an inspiring celebration of two of the most influential figures in American literature, Maya Angelou and James Baldwin, Dr. Alethea Legal Miller, and a senior lecturer in American history and culture at Canterbury Christ Church University, and Yasin Abdel-Majid, a Sudanese-Australian writer, broadcaster and award-winning social advocate, dive into the lives and legacies of the two iconic friends, whose shared experiences in the civil rights movement and deep connections to religion shape their profound contributions to poetry and the arts. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, delve into the enduring impact of Angelou and Baldwin's intertwined lives and works in a celebration of their remarkable journey together.
How are we all? Not bad. Am I going to be... How are we all? There we go. I'm sorry. I know it's a bit of a hype situation to be doing on a Sunday afternoon, but we're so glad that you're here. I'm Yasmin Abdel-Majid, and I'm here with the lovely...
Althea Legal Miller. And you actually all do look excited. So have you come out of the documentary screening?
Yeah, hands up
okay,
if you just saw
so
the documentary.
Right.
Amazing. Okay. Yes. So the way that we're going to kind of structure this is we're going to have a little bit of a conversation. I'll do a bunch of readings kind of throughout from both Baldwin and Maya Angelou's works. And then we'll hand it over to you for questions because we would really love, you know, a bit of a Q&A if that's all right with you. Amazing. So, doctor, and I'm going to call you doctor because you're a doctor and why not?
Thank you.
How did so you teach civil rights at Canterbury...
Christchurch. So I could do a little intro just so you know who I am. So yes, Dr. Althea Legal Miller. The name Althea might resonate with some of you. So I was named after the wonderful tennis player Althea Gibson. So I'm seeing some nods. So I feel like part of the legacy of great Black Americans have been part of my life from an early age. Even through my name, and just fascinated with history and culture of the US. In fact, the vast majority of my extended family live in the United States. So I didn't grow up with cousins and uncles, grandparents, they're all in the States. We originally, my family, are Guyanese. Any Guyanese in the house? Yay! There's always one. So... Hi, Auntie. But my mother and father didn't know each other, but they made a decision as the only siblings in their large families to come to England. Everybody else went from Guyana to the States, which is why I have hundreds of relatives in the US and this very small immediate family here in the UK. And as I was saying to Yasmin, part of growing up was always looking to the States to see what my life may have been like. That there was another me, an echo of me, that I could have by fate, some smaller decisions, different decisions in migration could have been an African American. And so I've always had my eye on that and it's taken me to my professional life. So I am a historian. My specialism is the civil rights movement. I'm particularly interested in issues of policing and more specifically police brutality. And so I've written on this from the civil rights movement to Black Lives Matter, looking at policing, issues of police brutality, and particularly how Black women have had to navigate police brutality. So that's me in a nutshell. I think we should do your intro.
All right, I'll give just a little bit of a spiel. So my background, I was born in Sudan. My family actually moved to Australia when I was about a year and a half. My mum had a pen pal, a sort of a very old school. She found this sort of address in a magazine sometime in her university years, and they started exchanging literal letters. And that's, you know, the family that took us in when we first moved to Australia in the 90s. And so what that meant was that I grew up in a context. We were the second Sudanese family in Brisbane. The other family lived about an hour and a half drive away, and the next family didn't come until about 10 years later. And that meant that my understanding of race and my understanding of kind of movements was less actually about what we might understand as the civil rights movement growing up and much more about anti-imperialism. I sort of grew up in the canon of anti-imperialism, thinking about, you know, Sudan's independence movement, but also the related ones, Algeria and so on, kind of in the region. Also, being Sudanese, I did engineering because that is, you know, engineering, law, not even law, to be fair, engineering and medicine. And if, you know, if you can't pass anything else, then you can do law. But that's beside the point. So did engineering and then kind of came to the work of the civil rights movement of the United States kind of in my mid-20s when I left Australia, moved to the UK, and wanted to kind of understand the concept of race as distinct to my parents' idea of race. Because my parents' idea of race was very much around the Sudanese concept of racialization, the which was much more about tribalism and ethnicity and colorism and so on. And so I didn't grow up thinking of myself as black. I didn't think of myself as related to these other movements. And then I moved to the UK, and I remember somebody saying to me, like, I had described myself, I mean, in my first book, I'm an author, my memoir, I described myself as a brown woman. And they were like, but weren't you born in Sudan? I was like, well, yeah, but look at me, I'm brown. And she was like, that's not what race is. I was like, oh. She was like, no, here you're black. She was like, I don't know what you are in Sudan and I don't know what you are in Australia, but here you're black. And also the added context, I should say, is that in Australia, black typically, when I grew up, referred to the Indigenous Australians, right? So like that, it had a very specific meaning. And so it meant in my mid-20s, I kind of began this journey of understanding race in a more kind of Anglo-American context, was introduced. This is embarrassing, but I'll share it so you know. When I first heard the name James Baldwin, I was like, how is Alec Baldwin's brother black? I'm humbling myself in front of you all. I was like, how fascinating. Yeah. What a family.
Yeah.
but of course, when I was then introduced to his work, and Baldwin in particular, I think his engagement, I can't imagine what it would have been like for him to write about the things he wrote about in the time that he did, because he was so searing in his honesty and he was so searing in his like excavation of self in order to understand self, in order to understand race. He left and lived in Paris for a number of years, as you might know if you'd seen the documentary and so on. He wrote books like Giovanni's Room and other incredible texts. For me, there were two essays in particular that I think struck me, and I want to share a little bit of them with you. Is that all right? The first was from one called Stranger in the Village. Is anyone familiar with Stranger? Hands up if you... Great. I love... Baldwin writes this essay as he moves to a tiny Swiss village in order to write. And I'll read just a little bit from the beginning and then I'll take an excerpt from the middle. From all available evidence, no black man has ever set foot in this tiny Swiss village before I came. I was told before arriving that I would probably be a sight for the village. I took this to mean that people of my complexion were rarely seen in Switzerland, and also that city people are always something of a sight outside the city. It did not occur to me, possibly because I am American, that there could be people anywhere who had never seen a Negro. And then he writes about kind of wandering around and about how the children would run and yell the N-word at him as he walked past, but not quite realizing the weight that that word carried. But something that struck him, I thought of white men arriving for the first time in an African village, strangers there, as I am a stranger here, and tried to imagine the astounded populace touching their hair and marveling at the color of their skin. But there is a great difference between being the first white man to be seen by Africans and being the first black man to be seen by whites. The white man takes the astonishment as tribute, for he arrives to conquer and to convert the natives, whose inferiority in relation to himself is not even to be questioned, whereas I, without a thought of conquest, find myself among a people whose culture controls me, has even, in a sense, created me. People who have cost me more in anguish and in rage than they will ever know, and yet do not even know of my existence. The astonishment with which I might have greeted them, should they have stumbled into my African village a few hundred years ago, might have rejoiced their hearts. But the astonishment with which they greet me today can only poison mine. And this is so despite everything I may do to feel differently, despite my friendly conversation with the bistro's owner's wife, despite their three-year-old son who has at last come my friend, despite the saluts and bonsoirs which I exchange with people as I walk, despite the fact that I know no individual can be taken to task for what history is doing or has done. I say that the culture of these people controls me, but they can scarcely be held responsible for European culture. America comes out of Europe, but these people have never seen America, nor have most of them seen more of Europe than the hamlet at the foot of their mountain. Yet they move with an authority which I shall never have, and they regard me quite rightly not only as a stranger in their village, but as a suspect latecomer, bearing no credentials to everything they have, however unconsciously inherited. For this village, even were it incomparably more remote and incredibly more primitive, is the West. The West onto which I have been so strangely grafted. These people cannot be, from the point of view of power, strangers anywhere in the world. They have made the modern world, in effect, even if they do not know it. The most illiterate among them is related in a way that I am not to Dante, Shakespeare, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Rembrandt, and Racine. The cathedral at Chartres says something to them which it cannot say to me, as indeed would New York's Empire State Building, should anyone here ever see it. Out of their hymns and dances come Beethoven and Bach. Go back a few centuries, and they are in their full glory. But I am in Africa, watching the conquerors arrive. Isn't he brilliant?
Thank you.
So, I mean, I'm just going to throw this question to you. What was the context in which Baldwin was writing in the time that he was writing? Could you give us a sense of that? So he, you know, another one of his essays, Notes of a Native Son, he writes kind of reflecting back to this time in World War II and the kind of the context of black Americans being sent to fight and then coming back and experiencing Jim Crow and so on. So can we paint that picture a little bit?
Yeah, the 1950s, Baldwin isn't in the US, but he has published, as you said, a number of works in the 50s. And so it's useful to sketch out, well, what is happening within the US, but also in a global context in the 50s. And here we can obviously bring in Maya Angelou as well, and how she's operating in the 1950s as well. Big movements in the United States, landmark Supreme Court ruling. So we have Brown v. Board. What does that do? It outlaws. It says it's unlawful to racially segregate in schools. This should therefore be really the end of racial apartheid in the US. If you take the legal precedent and you say, look, it's unconstitutional to racially segregate in a state school, then of course it must be the same logic. It's illegal to do it on a bus. It's illegal to do it in the library. It's illegal to do it at swimming pools, all of these public spaces. But of course we know that it's going to take a movement of which, you know, Baldwin and Angelou are both part of, and hopefully we get an opportunity to talk about their, you know, civil rights work, which is really of particular interest to me. But so it's not the end, but we've got 1955, this landmark judgment, and it brings waves of white resistance that the South the South's way of living will not die at the hands of people who sit on the Supreme Court and other liberals, that you don't understand the Southern way of living. Of course, 55 is also the murder of the black teenager, Emmett Till. That's a galvanizing moment for many in the black community and for a lot of youth, who this becomes this very conscious moment in the way a Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown in 2015, this death of a teenager at the hands of this racial violence, and how that's mobilizing a community, but young people as well. At 55, you have a major bus boycott. Rosa Parks is the face of that boycott, but it's the very first time that you'll see Martin Luther King, you know, mobilizing and organizing. And this boycott lasts for over a year. It's, you know, black people don't use the buses. If we're not going to be treated with dignity and we're going to be racially segregated, don't use the buses. And thousands upon thousands of black Americans are walking to and from work. Kids are walking to schools and they are not on the buses. So a lot is happening. Globally, also, you've got a major, you know, Asian African conference in Indonesia. You've got decolonizing movements. Ghana wins its independence in the 50s. So a lot is happening in the 50s. A lot of radical thought, a lot of individuals, and it's happening on a global stage. So how do you fight racism? And for folks like Baldwin and Maya Angelou, they're understanding that this is a global struggle. It's not one of the US. And in fact, we can perhaps use the methods and tools of decolonizing movements within our own organizing, and that racism and imperialism are, you know, these twin pillars that need to be fought together. And so they're part of this 50s in which, you know, it's a Cold War context. So the US, there's leverage here. The US want to project an image of freedom, of this land of democracy. And we have folks like Baldwin and Maya Angelou saying, well, we're going to speak the truth of this country. It's a little more complicated when we get to Maya Angelou, but I could tease out her.
Please do, because I think that, you know, quite often the poems that people associate with Angela were sort of about, you know, Still I Rise and Phenomenally Woman and these classics. But also, you know, she was quite like furious in her critique, I think, and quite engaged sort of robustly in a lot of the civil rights movement. So would you be able to tell us a little bit about that? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love the work of Maya Angelou. And our event today is And Still I Rise. That's... It's incredibly powerful, but Yasmin, as you rightfully say, and partly it's not that people are misreading Angelou. A lot of her autobiographies, of which there are 7, deal with issues of motherhood and issues of belonging and identity. And some of that radical work actually is appearing in earlier writing, in her fiction, in writing for communist magazines. You don't necessarily get a sense that Maya Angelou's writing spans from, and also her presence from, yeah, Cairo, Cuba, Ghana, that she is traveling and she's all in these different contexts. And part of her ability to travel, indeed, is because the State Department is sponsoring the theater production that she's in. That's Porgy and Best. So that's in the 50s. So Baldwin is in Paris already, 1948. He moves to Paris. She gets a chance to travel the world. But the State Department is sponsoring this production. They're traveling in North America. They're going to go to Cairo, the Middle East, and Western Europe. Now, why is the State Department sponsoring Porgy and Bess, which is starring Maya Angelou? And it's cultural diplomacy. It is, first and foremost, it's a Cold War tactic. It says to the Soviet Union, look, there are opportunities for blacks. Look how well we treat black people. And that America and the version of America is on the world stage. And so Maya Angelou's part of that. For her, she's able to support her son. She's a single mom. And she's also able to travel the world. And that's where she meets James Baldwin in Paris. And she's touring for Porgy and Bess. So, of course, this is an amazing personal opportunity. But Angelou will come to wrestle with the tension of what does it mean to be an ambassador of the US? And such a glowing and positive ambassador of the US. While she knows the truth of racism. And that rub of being able to expand your horizons, being able to meet great people like Baldwin, but at the same time, being used in the propaganda wing of the State Department becomes something that she will write about in her early fiction writing and her writing for, you know, communist magazines as well. And where she says, you know what, I need to actually be part of a civil rights movement, but also global movements. She's part of, you know, South African anti-apartheid movements. She's part of a Cuban group who are seeing that there's this unfair relations between Cuba and the US. And, you know, most famously, she's going to work for Martin Luther King and become a Northern coordinator for King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And by the 1950s, she's part of all of those groups and doing that work. 60, she's going to meet Malcolm X, but let's save Malcolm X for a little later in the conversation.
Yeah, so I thought I would share a couple of... So this collection, Just Give Me a Cool Drink of Water Before I Die, I think was a Pulitzer Prize-winning, nominated or Pulitzer Prize-winning?
Nominated.
And so I thought I would read a couple of just in relation to what you were saying, yeah. Doctor. There's one poem called America, which I think is her sort of starting to speak to some of these yeah. realizations. The gold of her promise has never been mined, the borders of justice not clearly defined. Her crops of abundance, the fruit and the grain, have not fed the hungry nor eased that deep pain. Her proud declarations are leaves on the wind, her southern exposure black death did befriend. Discover this country, dead centuries cry, erect noble tablets where none can decry. She kills her bright future, and rapes for a sow, then entraps her children with legends untrue. I beg you, discover this country. And then one other one I wanted to share from this collection called On Working White Liberals, and I'm not sure at what point she was writing this, but it goes as such. I don't ask the Foreign Legion or anyone to win my freedom or to fight my battle better than I can. Though there's one thing that I cry for, I believe enough to die for. That is every man's responsibility to man. I'm afraid they'll have to prove first that they'll watch the black man move first, then follow him with faith to kingdom come. This rocky road is not paved for us, so I'll believe in liberals' aid for us when I see a white man load a black man's gun. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do a slight gear change back to yeah. Baldwin because there's this, one of the essays, so this collection of essays is called Notes of a Native Son, and the title essay I find like a masterclass. And so the context of this essay, Notes of a Native Son, is essentially about Baldwin's father. It is a single day, early August, it is his father's funeral. It is also the day that his ninth sibling is being born. It is also his birthday, and it is the day of a major, what's termed as a race riot in Harlem, which was in response to sort of things happening at the global scale in terms of black people being sent to fight. The story goes that the riot was kicked off because a white police officer had shot a black soldier who had returned from war, who was defending a black woman. This story didn't bear out necessarily to be true, but that didn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. It was sort of representing a particular moment in time. But the essay itself is about Baldwin's relationship with his father, or actually his stepfather, but he always treated his stepfather as his actual father. There was no kind of change in the fact that he was not a biological son. And his father was from New Orleans, born to a woman who was enslaved. So he's very close to that sort of period of enslavement. And by all accounts, his father was an incredibly tyrannical man. And Baldwin kind of writes about this in a really searing way, but I think also something that he realizes, which I think is like a complexity that he grapples with, and the tragedy of it, is that his father seemed to be trying to do all he can or could to protect his children from the world. And his way of trying to protect his black children from the world meant that there was cruelty in the home. But that was his way of kind of dealing with that, to prepare his children for a world that would show them more cruelty than they could ever imagine, so to speak. But that meant that all of his children were deeply afraid of him. And so this is sort of Baldwin, I think, speaking about his father and the demons, perhaps, that his own father had to deal with. It had something to do with his blackness, I think. He was very black, with his blackness and his beauty, and with the fact that he knew he was black but did not know he was beautiful. He claimed to be proud of his blackness, but it had also been the cause of much humiliation, and it had fixed bleak boundaries to his life. He was not a young man when we were growing up, and he had already suffered many kinds of ruin. In his outrageously demanding and very protective way, he loved his children, who were black like him and menaced like him. And all these things sometimes showed in his face when he tried, never to my knowledge with any success, to establish contact with any of us. When he took one of his children on his knee to play, the child always became fretful and began to cry. When he tried to help one of us with our homework, the absolutely unabating tension which emanated from him caused our minds and our tongues to become paralyzed, so that he, scarcely knowing why, flew into a rage, and the child, not knowing why, was punished. If it ever entered into his head to bring a surprise home for his children, it was, almost unfailingly, the wrong surprise. And even the big watermelons he often brought home on his back in the summertime led to the most appalling scenes. I do not remember in all those years that one of his children was ever glad to see him come home. From what I was able to gather of his early life, it seemed that this inability to establish contact with other people had always marked him and had been one of the things which had driven him out of New Orleans. There was something in him, therefore, groping and tentative, which was never expressed and which was buried with him. One saw it most clearly when he was facing new people and hoping to impress them. But he never did, not for long. We went from church to smaller and more improbable church. He found himself in less and less demand as a minister, and by the time he died, none of his friends had come to see him for a long time. He had lived and died in an intolerable bitterness of spirit, and it frightened me as we drove him to the graveyard through those unquiet, ruined streets, to see how powerful and overflowing this bitterness could be, and to realize that this bitterness was now mine. When he died, I had been away from home for a little over a year, and in that year, I had time to become aware of the meaning of all my father's bitter warnings, had discovered the secret of his proudly pursed lips and rigid carriage. I had discovered the weight of white people in the world. I saw that this had been for my ancestors and now would be for me, an awful thing to live with, and that the bitterness which had helped to kill my father could also kill me. And part of, I guess, why I wanted to share that and something that I think is I mean, this is what Baldwin is so excellent at, is so excellent at sort of so clearly naming the tragedy, but also somehow making it human and relatable. And there is a man who was a tyrant, and yet you feel for him because he brings a humanity and an understanding, I think, to characters that we might not naturally assume to give, I suppose. The other aspect maybe about this is like the way that we think about Baldwin talking about the sort of inherited bitterness, right? And the closeness, being that close to enslavement. And then he later goes on to talk about, you know, he was brought up, you know, in the North. His father had deliberately chosen to sort of bring them up in the North. And then when he first then went to the South, and he'd sort of heard about Jim Crow, but he had never experienced it. And so when he started to experience it, he was like, what is happening? Even though he had kind of grown up with hearing the stories and understanding. And I guess I just want to explore that a little and maybe even think about it in the contemporary sense. Like, what is it, how do we kind of think about, you know, ancestral bitterness and how even if somebody might be generations away from a particular tragedy, trauma, how that kind of is passed on in this way?
Yes, I was thinking the same thing. This, there is a preoccupation around bitterness and naming what that is. Both authors do that. In fact, Maya Angelou said of James Baldwin that he was not bitter, he was angry. And so there's a distinction there. And hopefully in the Q&A, maybe we can open that up on what people think of the distinction between bitterness and anger. What Angelou says of the distinction is that anger is useful. It can be expressed. It can transmute. It is an expression. But bitterness is internal. So it eats away and it destroys inside. And Baldwin writes about the bitterness of his father, not the anger of his father. And he says of his, you know, of his father, he wouldn't bend. He was too proud to bend. So he had to be broken. And he was broken through that bitterness. As you said, that's part of the, it's not magic. It's skill and it's talent, but it, at some point it almost looks magical, but
it's potent, right? Yeah. There's a potency to it, I think.
Yeah. Of being able to make that distinction so clearly, clear enough for us to grapple with it, not that it's, you know, here's the notes and, oh, of course, it makes sense now. Not in that way. But certainly the beginning of how do we begin to note the nuances here, of which both authors do so well. You know, for Maya Angelou, this, the issue of bitterness and making sure that she, the bitterness wouldn't take her over, obviously starts at that crucial moment of personal violation. And we probably all know this story in the room of her rape at the age of 7 and what that could have done to her internally throughout her life, and how she uses that and attempts to understand it, never to excuse it, but to understand it and the place of violence in society. And how violence against women and girls is also functioning within a society and within a white supremacist context, and linking those together. Of course, you know, the childhood is the subject, you know, from, you know, a young child to about age 16 when she's pregnant is the I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. That's what she's dealing with in there. And she talks about why she was so attracted to Martin Luther King and his methods of black liberation, how black liberation would be achieved within a non-violent context. And she says she'd seen so much violence that she herself had been violated. And so when she saw that liberation, perhaps the strategy could be won and fought and struggled through nonviolence, it was like water to a parched desert, and that resonated to her. if a non-violent solution could be found. And the ways in which these authors are navigating, you know, space and place and violence is particularly interesting. And I guess a question for you, someone who leaves your home, and of course you've got to trouble this notion of home, but is understanding about their home and learning about themselves and life and these bigger social structures outside of your place of birth, as these two are doing, does that resonate with you? And some of those locales, a Paris, you know, Ghana, a Cairo.
Yeah, it's. I mean, this is something that I spend a lot of time thinking about and have written about. I actually wrote an essay collection while I lived in Paris. And I remember when I arrived to Paris, I was like, I'm going to be James Baldwin in Paris. This is my James Baldwin in Paris moment. But it was not the 1950s and I'm not black. I mean, sorry, I'm not a black American and I'm not a man. Mm. And also I'm not Christian. I'm a Sudanese migrant Muslim woman who wears a hijab in Paris. And that is a very different thing.
Yes, it is.
And I think, you know, it was very interesting grappling with the ideas that these black American authors engage with. And yes, they do sort of, I think, I don't think Baldwin had the sort of space when he lived in Paris to engage with necessarily the Algerian movement in the way, the Algerian independence movement in the way that perhaps others did. But I think it was very clear to me that the relationship between the US and France is a very particular one, affords the black American a very particular place in France, Josephine Baker and so on. There is a history there that you can kind of enter into. And France, even though it loves to be like we are French, they still do have this kind of, you know, sense of place in America as well, a relationship to that nation state. A sense that it is of an, not necessarily the equal, but in stature, it has the space in the French imagination to still respect. Whereas it does not have that respect for, you know, an African, a Muslim, a hijabi, and so on. And so I found it actually, and this is a bit of a tangent, I found it challenging when people would say to me, oh my God, it must be so amazing to be a writer in Paris. And I'm like, well, what you imagine, like, you know, it's not Emily in Paris, you know. Yasmin in Paris is a very different story. There's a lot more police brutality in Yasmin in Paris, you know what I'm saying? Which is always very awkward for polite small talk. but I think what's the other thing, and I had a quibble with Baldwin on this, and I my essay collection is called Talking About Revolution. In my first essay, you know, I'm troubling the idea of the nation state and our relationship to the nation state and our idea of citizenship and our desire for citizen, you know, the place in which we place citizenship in our conception of the world. And Baldwin says, I love America, which is why I reserve the right to critique it. This is why I critique America so heavily, because I love it. I'm like, why do you have to love America? Why? Why does any nation deserve love? Why should we have that relationship with a nation state? A form of organizing society that only started in the 1600s, that is incredibly, you know, Western European, that frankly, we feel in our modern society that we can justify almost any amount of violence to secure borders that are completely quote-unquote man-made, because they typically are men-made, right? Why do we feel like we have to love such a construction? I completely disagree with that. And so I would actually argue I think this is something on which I differ deeply, actually, with these writers that I have so much respect for, is the fact that, you know, I don't feel like a relationship to the nation state in the way that they do. I think there is a desire for the black American for lots of natural reasons, right? Understandable reasons to fight for a place within the American project. I completely get that. But that is completely different from my kind of fight, as it were. I don't know how much you guys know about what's happening in Sudan. It's really awful. Mm-hmm. That is not comparable to, like, not having your rights in a country that exists. It's very different to not having rights in a country that may never exist again in the way that it ever did. And so I think that that ultimately, when it comes to thinking about civil rights, when it comes to I think, you know, that is where the African, perhaps we can say, and I just speak from my positionality, will always be different to the Black American. It is not hyperbole to say that Sudanese lives do not matter. Right. Sudanese lives are not Black lives in what we understand as Black lives. Sudanese lives, I mean, it is literally the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. When was the last time you heard about it on the news? Really? There is not a single capital city in the world that is being bombed in the way Khartoum is being bombed right now, but you wouldn't know about it. 25 million people are in need of aid right now, but you wouldn't know about it. There is a literal genocide happening in Darfur right now. Again, they are trying to complete the genocide that they began 20 years ago, but you may have heard a little bit here or there, maybe if you're listening to BBC World Service, but it does not demand the same attention that the plight of the Black American ever will. And I think that is the tragedy. I think there is so much that I personally, and sorry, this has become the Yasmeen show, but there is so much that I sort of relate to and respect in the works of Baldwin and Angelou, and at the same time, I think there is a deep understanding that it is, at some level, always distinct, because they write from within the heart of the empire, of an empire. And that is always fundamentally different. I think if you are, you know, in the periphery or in the colonies. So on that, maybe we should go to questions. Yeah. What do we think? All right, just take a breath. And then thank you so much, everyone, for all your attention. We have a roving mic, and we would really love if you could wait for the mic. So can we get hands up if you have a question? Oh, yeah, we've got one here. Thank you.
Hi, you mentioned in the blurb about this talk about how faith, lack of faith or a faith. I wondered if you just explore what both of the writers, how faith affected what they did.
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, James Baldwin was a boy preacher for 3 years, up until age 14. And there, I mean, that desire, the way in which to connect with people, I think we should also, the connection between love and faith and the power of love, not in a sentimental way, but in a political way, how it can operate. I do think both authors are grappling with that. But yeah, Baldwin is this boy preacher. Partly this is, you know, something his father wants of him, and stepping away from that is because Christianity cannot address and does not address some of these key injustices. Indeed, Christianity has been used within a so-called Christian nation. James Baldwin will say, America cannot be a Christian nation, obviously. Not living up to, say, the true principles of Christianity, much like how James Baldwin will say, you know, these yet United States of America. So Christianity being in a perpetual failing state, the US being in a perpetual failing state, although it's, I think it's really interesting the way in which you can still have a love for something that's failing and still be invested in it, because part of that failure is you. But we can maybe work some of that out together in an audience. Any, I guess, on Maya Angelou and faith?
What I would sort of say to build on that is Baldwin's relationship with his faith complicates as time goes by, especially with in relation to his sexuality and so on. And so, you know, and some of his fiction is really, I think, there again is like maybe an anger or a tragedy in relation to his relationship with the church. I think it is something he is consistently grappling with, but I would never say that he completely leaves it behind or sort of decides that it has no place in his life. From my understanding, I think Angelou has, you know, her sense of faith remains throughout her life, but I must confess that this is something I know a little less about, but thank you for the question.
And there's also Nation of Islam conversations that Baldwin is having with Elijah Muhammad, but also via through Malcolm X, who's really key for both of these individuals. We didn't actually say their deep friends. You know, this is a deeply loving friendship. And they both express a love and fondness for Malcolm X. They are also interested in Islam via the Nation of Islam and how that operates. Some of the tenets don't work for individuals. So James Baldwin will say, yeah, the stance on separatist stance don't work for me, but there are other elements that make sense or that I want to learn about. You know, writers, and you're a writer, you're curious people.
Well, yeah, the other thing, the thing that you're making me reflect on is, like, how amazing it is that these were friends who were able to have such robust discussions about the sort of... And I think this is something that we can learn from, right? Because, you know, like, an engagement with faith systems that might not be their own, an engagement with ideas that they might not agree with, but a sort of a security in the friendship and a security in the respect for one another, which says that we may actually have different positions on this, but I'm going to engage with it. Like, we're going to sort of engage in good faith here. We're going to, like, see that we are trying to work towards the same thing, and although it might not be that we are choosing to do that in the same way, that won't fracture us. And that is so vital for any sort of forward movement, is that rather than sort of seeing these differences as fracture points, they're sort of ways in which multiple things feed into, you know, one particular direction. Thank you for the question. Yeah. Any other hands? Do we have... Not all at once. Yes. Okay, thank you.
Baldwin famously said that he didn't write for black men, he didn't write for white men, he wrote for everyone. Would you say that that statement is still or even more relevant today, considering, Yasmin, what you said about obviously what's taking place in Sudan and obviously what we're seeing in the news about everything going on in Gaza and stuff like that? Would you say that you can get a universal message from it, or would you say that it is still strikingly relevant in terms of sort of the black community and the ongoing fight for rights and representation in that society as well?
Yeah, great question. I'm going to be a bit cheeky. I think that, like, an author can say they write for whoever they want, but what an author's intention is and the way that is received in the world are very different things. I can be like, I'm writing for everybody, but a very specific group of people read and resonate with my work. You know, my intentions are what they are, but the way that it sits in the world, I think, is determined by lots of different things. I mean, Baldwin, I would say, for many black people, black Americans, but also, like, racialized people who are black across the world, has a, you know, remains kind of potent and urgent. I think that's through his craft and his skill as an essayist in particular. But also, I think what he does well is the specificity of his writing allows it to be universal, right? So I actually don't know what it's like to be, you know, a gay man in Paris, but I can read Giovanni's Room and feel moved and feel engaged and so on. And so, like, I think, you know, I don't know what it's like to have eight siblings and a tyrannical father who, you know, is the son of an enslaved woman, and yet something in that passage moves me and I understand it. And so that is the success, I would say, of his work, is that even if he meant it to be for everybody, he sort of happened on the truth that the universe, the sort of very specific, can be incredibly universal. Did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, just quickly, because you mentioned Giovanni's Room, so you've got, you know, an American black gay man writing about a white gay man. So these are complex identities. I do, I'm sure you too, this, we gotta deconstruct this notion of the universal. It comes with a lot of baggage. However, there are archetypes, there are points of entry. It is not exclusive writing. Again, I will toss to you as a writer, is there that label of black writer, do you think? No.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is true that, you know, one part of the challenge is also in the world of publishing and in the marketing and in so on, is that, you know, both Angelou and Baldwin will still be presented as black writers, black poets, black whatever. And I think both of them would probably quibble with that. Mm. You know, they, and I think many writers today, I know, for example, that is the lens, you know, the fact that I'm a Muslim writer or a, you know, a migrant, what, these are the ways in which the publishing industry will want to sell you. And that has actually nothing to do. In fact, quite often we will talk about the content of the writing and not actually about the prose and the craft and the skill, which is why they have been so, you know, they are timeless works of art. And that is something that is challenging, I would say, still. But thank you. I think we have time for maybe one more question. Do we have time? Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. Thank you. This side of the room is doing some heavy lifting, buzzing. Everybody. I just want you all to take notes.
Given the idea of black writers like myself and other people like that, how would you perceive the idea of people like Baldwin and other writers who are mainly ignored in the British curriculum? They're just dismissed, or they're seen as a black writer, and you get a little piece one day in November on that week and nowhere else throughout the curriculum. What would you suggest we do?
Politics of the curriculum.
Yeah. Well, if I was the... I think we know, really. It is actually not that difficult, right? Like, the logistics... Like, actually being like, let's put more writers of colour, let's put more black writers in the curriculum. It's not a scientifically difficult thing to do, right? It is a question of will, frankly. It's a question of will. And, I mean... 14 years of Tory rule and Michael Gove being in charge of the curriculum, you can tell there isn't much will, right? The other thing I would also say that is interesting is, like, I, at the very, like, all the quibbles I have with the United States, at the very least, there is a place for a black voice in their curriculums. Right. In the UK, I'm sorry, Bernardine Evaristo had to write 9 books before anyone, like, before she sort of had a place in the canon, and it had to win the Booker. Right? One of my favorite authors, Abdelrazak Gurnah, who is this incredible sort of post-colonial writer who was originally from, like, Tanzania, Zanzibar, but has been in the UK for 50 years, is a British citizen, won the Nobel Prize. Do any of you know his name? Is he in the curriculum? No, he's incredible. He won the Nobel Prize. The president of Zanzibar or Tanzania or whatever called him up. Did he even get a letter from, like, one of the ministers? No, because there is no respect in this country. I'm still on a visa. maybe on that note, folks, we are at time. Thank you so much for coming and joining us. Give it up for Dr.
Thank you.
Ivan Nismeen, thank you so much. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2024.